The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, DearlyDepartedTours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
All you who have gone before, please listen now. We are listening to all you who have gone before. Join us in peace. Crossing the river of life and death.
Listening to
crossing the river of spirit and breath. Crossing the river of life and death.
Listening to
crossing the river of spirit and breath. Crossing the river of life and death.
Listening to
crossing the river of spirit and breath. Crossing the river of life and death.
Listening to
crossing the river of spirit and breath. Crossing the river of life and death.
Listening to
crossing the river of spirit and breath. Crossing the river of life and death.
Listening to
all you who have gone before, join us in peace.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Merry meet and welcome once again to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Para-X Radio Network. Tonight's opener was The Ancestor Chant by Sharon Knight and T. Thorne Coyle. And I chose that because my guest tonight is Raven Grimasi. Now, Raven is a neo-pagan scholar and a very prolific award-winning author of somewhere around 20 books or so on Wicca and witchcraft. And he brings over 45 years of personal experience into the practice of ritual, magic, spell casting, and occult mysticism, and is also initiate of several Wiccan traditions. Raven considers it his life work to ensure the survival of ancient witch lore and legend, along with ancestral teachings about the old world witchcraft. And tonight we're going to be talking about his latest book, Communing with the Ancestors, Your Spirit Guides, Bloodline Allies, and the Cycle of Reincarnation. If you have any questions for Raven and you're in the Para-X chat room, please send me a private message and I'll pass it on. And if you're not in the chat room, you're going to have to pop over to come and ask. So join us at www.para-x.com. Raven, welcome to Stirring the Cauldron.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited. This is a favorite topic of mine, in a sense, because I've always been very vocal about the necessity of remembering and respecting the ancestors, as right. well as acknowledging them in the here and now. Mm-hmm. And I was elated when I received this book from your publisher, because not only can I help stress the importance of communing with the ancestors, but now I can also refer everybody to your book so they can learn how to effectively do that. So,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for writing this one. You know, there are people who wander through life unable to find their clear path very easily, and others find them really easily for whatever reason. Now, I always knew who and what I was and what path I should be on, but I didn't seriously follow it until way later than I expected. But, you know, I kind of believe that things come to us not necessarily when we want them to, but when we're ready for them. And you were talking about in the book, and we just said about sharing the information and teaching people about the ancestors and old world ways. When did you realize you're a path?
I think I'm still realizing my path.
Good answer, you're right.
Yeah, you know, it's been a different journey, just like life itself, you know, different phases of where I thought I was going and where I wanted to go and where I ended up. So I don't really think I could pinpoint a starting place and certainly not an ending point.
No. Mm-mm. Even after we leave this plane, we're going to still be on that same path. So
That's right.
It never goes away. Now, in writing the book, much of the information came to you from ancestral voices and a handful of, as you call it, other world allies.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably gives the readers a whole different perspective on the topic than if you had just done research and sat down and just wrote it on your own. Mm-hmm. Do you think the ancient ones were pushing you to write this book to begin with? 'Cause I think you weren't so sure about doing it, right?
Right. Well, once the agreement was made, things went quite well. It was just getting to that point because, as I mentioned, I believe in either the preface or the intro. Thorne Coyle was actually instrumental in encouraging me to do this work. I had never thought to do a book on the ancestors, and we would meet at different conventions, and she would bring it up and suggest that I do that. And I always told her I don't have a book's worth. I could do a nice essay, but I just don't have a book's worth on the ancestors. So she said, well, you know, go to them and talk to them and see, you know. So I did and got nothing and told her that. And she said, try again, you know. So I went back and tried again and nothing. And as I say in the book, the oddest thing happened. My wife and I were sitting at the IHOP having breakfast and talking about this book. And I was telling her, it's just not coming. The ancestors aren't giving me any encouragement. I don't think I have a book's worth. I said, I'm not going to write this book. So we left the restaurant, got in the car, went to start up the car, and right in front of us, this semi-truck pulled in, the long trailer. And there was one word and one word only on the trailer, and it was ancestral. And there was no website, no phone number, no address, no company name, just this one word stretching the entire length of this truck, ancestral. And my wife looks at me and she goes, so? Looks like I'm writing a book on the ancestors.
Yeah, they're not usually very subtle, are they?
But it was a challenge because I normally sit down and write kind of from my personal knowing and then try to expand upon that. Mm-hmm. But every time I tried that with this book, the ancestral voice was like, no, we're not doing the same old thing. This isn't just yet another book on the ancestors. Mm-hmm. So you need to get out of the way and let this book be written. So that's really what I ended up doing. I feel more like a co-author of this book, I often tell people, than I do the author itself. There were times when I became a student of this book as it was being written. I learned new things. I mean, literally, I'd be typing something and I would say, really? I never knew that. Or I never thought that. I was having those moments with the book and it was astonishing. And I learned so much from just being out of the way and let the ancestral voice come through. At one point, I felt like I was abandoning some of the things I formerly believed in. But the ancestral voice said, no, you're not. You're just climbing up on our shoulders to gain a higher perspective.
Mm.
So that was a kindness on their part, you know, let me off the hook.
Right.
But we had this journey, my ancestors and the ancestors. Because this was what Thorne was saying, Coyle. She said, don't write about your ancestors, write about the ancestors. And that's really how the book came to be.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like what you wrote about how some people believe that ancestors are only in the past, but in truth that they're conscious beings and not all detached at all from the world of the living. Right. Why do you think they're so interested in us in the current times?
Right. Well, you know, they once lived on this planet, and they have what was passed to me by the ancestral voice is that just like a person has a purpose or a goal in life, our blood lineage line does as well. That blood lineage line is trying to accomplish something it's set out in time to do. Mm-hmm. And this is why the ancestors have a vested interest in us, because we are the living stewards of the bloodline, and we are the living keepers who can be the agents for fulfillment of the lineage mission. So this is why that they're so interested in us. Plus, they are the memory. You know, they are the organic memory of our race. And as long as we live, they live as well. And, you know, it was interesting because in the process, the ancestors told me or passed to me this idea of what is the difference between the dead and the ancestors, which I thought was fascinating because they were saying that the dead are remembered directly by the living. So there has to be at least one living person who knew that dead person in order for the dead to still be among the dead. But once there's no one alive who ever knew you, ever met you, talked to you, once there's no one left, you slip into the ancestral realm. Mm-hmm. You're no longer among the dead. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really interesting because the dead are really still in relationship, personal relationship with the living. But the ancestors aren't really because they're from the past. We never met them.
Yeah, and you know, along those lines, there's something that keeps being brought up to me a lot in regards to communicating with the ancestors, because people get confused about who to try and communicate with. I mean, most know their grandparents and at least know maybe about their great-grandparents, but in truth, that's just the tip of the iceberg when you consider the ancestors we have had in previous lives as well.
Yes.
You know, I don't think we should limit ourselves to just seeking the ancestors that we know of and acknowledging them. I think, you know, you have to embrace everybody and kind of include everybody because you never know who's going to be around. What are your thoughts about the best way to go about all this when we are trying to communicate and acknowledge?
Well, the way it was passed to me is that there is the ancestral realm, which would include all of our ancestors. Mm-hmm. And they exist within a hive mentality, so it's a group consciousness made up of all the parts. When we can commune with the forgotten ones, the ancestors, we then become more holistic in our being because now we have all the possibilities are in touch with us. One of the advantages of working with the ancestors is that they have collectively lived every experience we can possibly have and beyond. So by turning to them for aid, direction, counseling, mentorship, we have a powerful database, if you will, of life experience to draw upon. And I often have people write to me and they'll say, well, I'm adopted. I don't know who my ancestors are. And I tell them, your ancestors have never forgotten you. They're still in your blood. You know, so there's no barrier there. It's just a lack of that link, you know, that first link. But you can bypass that. You can go directly with what I call really the underworld within and meet your ancestors there.
And I think a lot of people are afraid to, well, it's kind of like that don't talk to strangers kind of thing, you know. I think they're afraid to dig deep. Either they think that somebody is, you know, there's a spirit on the other side that's lying to them about being Great Uncle Charlie or, know, or what. I don't know. I just would kind of feel comfortable just kind of opening up, and if it doesn't feel right, you close it, right? But you can't put the wall up before you know what's on the other side.
Yeah, and, you know, I've had people actually tell me that they don't really like their living family. And so why would they want to find, you know, connect with their past family, you know? And to me, that's the key. There's the pivotal point right there for the purpose of this whole thing, is because if you feel that way, then there's a log jam in the river of blood that's flowing through your body. Your body is beating the same blood of all of your ancestors. And the ancestors are, and the dead are alive within that river of blood. But when you estrange yourself from family, or you estrange yourself, you know, or be dismissive of the past, then that river of blood that's flowing through the generations becomes jammed with kind of the resentment or, you know, whatever it might be. And we have to clean that out as the living steward of the living river of blood. We have to clean out that debris because it liberates us to liberate our loved ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's part of the reason that we're here. I mean, we learn, we grow, but that's part of it too. And, you know, my favorite catchphrase when I'm always trying to make the point of remembering and honoring them is, if it weren't for them, there would be no us. And I mean, it's very simple. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yes.
And if, all right, suppose you're an ancestor, you know, I mean, suppose 300 years from now, the lineage goes down and nobody calls upon you or nobody remembers you or nobody even gives you credit for being alive. I mean, how would that make you feel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important, even if you don't know names or faces or their life stories, it's still important to acknowledge them.
I agree. You know, the dead and really the ancestors, they don't want to be forgotten.
Right.
I mean, who does, really?
Yeah.
As above, so below, you know. So I think by, as the kahunas say, if you honor your ancestors and you speak the family stories to the next generation, the same thing will happen to you when you cross over. And so by honoring tradition, you become honored in the tradition when you're no longer here, you know. So I think there's this idea of understanding that we can live through these traditions of veneration.
Mm-hmm. And I think even if people, and correct me if I'm wrong, even if people can't physically or metaphysically get in contact with their ancestors, the very least that they could do is to create an altar or a shrine and make offerings, correct?
Right, that's what I recommend really even as a basic fundamental thing to do, period, is to erect a little shrine somewhere in your house. It can be somewhere, you know, in a discreet area. But all you really need to do is put some symbolic items that represent your lineage. You know, if you're Irish, you know, put something, you know, shamrock or, you know, whatever. You know, something that to you kind of ties in with that culture. Mm-hmm. So you put a few symbols around. It's an alignment. Kind of brings you into, help you interface with the ancestors. And then I always say put at family occasions, weddings, marriages, birthdays, you know, funerals, any, whatever it might be, put food offerings on the shrine. Invite the ancestors to be part of this living river of blood that's still flowing. Mm-hmm. And these are things that take very little effort,
right?
But can be very profound in bringing you into interfacing with your ancestors.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I like the holiday thing about, you know, the vase of flowers or something, or even just something that, you know, if you knew that your great-grandfather Max loved a good cigar, leave him one.
Absolutely. Yeah, my father loved us. Particular licorice mix that comes around at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
So after he crossed, I would put those candies in front of his picture on his nightstand.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of a special connection, special treat, honoring. I think that because the dead don't want to be forgotten, I think to be remembered well, it must be very uplifting.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important for people to realize that, you know, some people are afraid to try to make an altar that because they think they're maybe doing something wrong. But in truth, there is no wrong way, is there?
No. It's all, you know, it's from the earliest of times, you know, humans have chosen a fallen log or a flat rock in a meadow, you know, as an altar. Whatever presents itself, whatever you can bring to the moment, you're just really looking for what I call the center point. Mm-hmm. You know, 'cause an altar is where you go to meet divinity or to meet your ancestors or even to meet yourself. Mm-hmm. So I think these altars can be something you find outside, something. It'd be as simple as the top of a bookcase,
mm-hmm.
You know, a nightstand. It really doesn't need to be elaborate. It just has to be a place where you can pause for a moment and give to something other than yourself.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have an altar in a bookcase shelf because I have a cat that if this was on a table would desecrate it, you know, just done.
Right.
But he can't get to that particular shelf. So as you said, it doesn't have to be elaborate. It could just be someplace that you can look at or sit in front of and that way. Now talking about ancestors, I'm going to get a little strange here for a minute, but not quite. It just reminded me of visiting the final resting places of our ancestors because many people know where they're buried, but then something else kind of pops into my head in that regard. Because I was visiting a cemetery years back, and the story will make sense in a minute, and I happened to lean on a very large tombstone of a total stranger. And for those of you in chat and listening who remember me telling this, forgive me because I'm really leading to something here. As I leaned on the stone, all of a sudden I got a tightness in my chest. I started having trouble breathing. At first I thought I was having a panic attack, but the minute I backed away from the stone, I felt fine. So here's what I'm getting at. If I picked up something like that from touching the tombstone of a total stranger, if I or anyone else were to visit the grave of an ancestor and touch their headstone, perhaps something amazingly good could come out of it. Am I making sense?
Yes. No, yeah. I think that's absolutely true. You know, if you stones hold memory and they're also connectors, they're like little synapsis points. One of the things that if you've ever noticed, if you've ever been to an ancient site where there's standing stones, the first thing that people do when they enter these sites is what? They put their hands on the stone as though it's a genetic memory to do that, you know. They put their palms up against the stone, and I think that part of the purpose of these sites was to have the stone retain memory of what had happened there, or the songs, the dances, the rituals, the veneration. So it attaches itself to stone because stone's so dense it holds energy for a very, very long time. And so I think that when you're in a graveyard, especially one that's actively maintained, the memories are refreshed within the graveyard stones. So I think you can have that kind of profound energetic exchange with a tombstone, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about it, I just thought, how lovely would it be to just touch that stone? I mean, not that ancestors hang out, or spirits in general, they don't hang out in cemeteries necessarily, but if they get wind of you going, they might just, you know, meet you there. But to just put your hands on the stone of an ancestor, in my great imagination, I keep thinking, God, you could just be filled with love. You could just be filled with such an uplifting feeling for doing it, you know, that it's really worth a shot. And I know a lot of people go to Ancestry.com. I mean, I've traced the family back on one side back hundreds of years, and I know where some of those people are buried. They're not around here, but I know where they're buried, and I would just love to just go and touch their stone, even though I didn't know them at all, but obviously they know me.
They still know you, which is the important thing to remember. They're not passive.
Mm-hmm. I know. I think that's really great. I've got a question from the chat room, and it kind of went away, Cece. She wrote a couple of things, and she kind of moved it up, and now I lost the first part of it. Cece, will you please just send me that first bit again? Because I just went to look, and it's not there. But in the meantime, we can talk about something else for a minute. Earlier, you mentioned the Cavern of Ancestors, and in the book, you offer a guided imagery to take us there, guided visualization. So again, let's get a little bit deeper into what the Cavern of the Ancestors is and what are we going to find if we go there?
Mm-hmm. It is an actual existing place. One might call it an astral realm. It's an agreement of consciousness in which the ancestors meet us in this one particular place that we can enter into as well. So it's kind of a halfway point between their realm and ours. It's in between the two. And it really holds the memory where you can actually meet with the ancestors. Often the first times that people do the exercises, they usually end up with the really far distant ancestors, almost, you know, back to sort of Paleolithic, Neolithic times. Mm-hmm. And so the connections are rather odd, you know, because there's no language, there's no, you know. But the more that you press and stay and venerate, all of a sudden there becomes figures, historical periods that you can actually identify. You know, the people around you are dressed, you know, in the 1700s or whatever. You can actually get there after you work with this technique for a while. But it also allows the ancestors to see us and to refresh that memory, because they've never really met us in the human persona we're wearing now.
Mm-hmm.
But by joining together, we see through their eyes to the past and they see through our eyes to the future. And I think that that's a very powerful thing. You know, they're willing to share their wisdom and knowledge, and they ask from us to be the eyes that they can look out into this world from the past.
So it's kind of, for people that might be familiar with the Akashic realm, kind of the same theory, isn't it?
It's close, yes. The idea that things are remembered. The Akashic records seem more to me about actions, thoughts, and things that are preserved in the mantle of the earth somehow energetically, almost like on a hard drive. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could access the files, you could pull up the data. Mm-hmm. Whereas the ancestor realm is more sentient,
mm-hmm.
you know, self-aware and self-directed. One of the things, for example, that the book deals with, which isn't in most books on the ancestors, is the idea of reincarnation.
Right.
And because people say, well, if everyone's reincarnating, then who are you talking to? If you're talking to your ancestors, haven't they already, you know, gone through rebirth?
Mm-hmm.
And so I tackle that with their help in this book to talk about this whole relationship of reincarnation and who's guiding it and why the ancestors are involved in it to begin with. So that's all sort of touched upon in the book.
Well, in regards to reincarnation, is it possible to call upon an ancestor that we once were? I'm asking that because there was a show on years ago where people were at a haunted location, and the medium in the group said that the spirit that this man was seeing and speaking to had identified himself as the past incarnation of one of the living people in the room. That ancestor spirit was now face to face with himself hundreds of years later, supposedly.
Huh.
So, you know, I mean, and that, I couldn't quite get my head around that, because if that was you, you know, you're here now, would you still be back there then? I mean, it got a little,
right. The way that I would look at that as an occultist would be a mm-hmm. little different.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that that person that was haunting was still among the dead and had not gone into the ancestral realm yet. And what it was doing was, it was the persona that had been shed that was seeing not the reincarnation of its form, but the soul that had borne that particular persona.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was recognizing. Sometimes the dead can remain among the dead even when no one alive remembers them, if they're mm-hmm. trapped in some energetic field.
Right.
So I would suspect, I don't know how old that persona was,
mm-hmm.
but from an occultist point of view, I would think that this was some dead character persona that was trapped, still retained the identity he had been in life. But what I was told by the ancestors is all the personas will be eventually absorbed back into the ancestral hive.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't remain, you know, you and I, for example, under that teaching would not remain as the individuals we believe ourselves to be right now. Eventually mm-hmm. we would fade into the ancestral realm and become, you know, more of the database.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, when they said it, I was like scratching my head. And then when we're talking about reincarnation, when I was reading the book, and it just kind of popped in that maybe I'm missing something here, but apparently I'm not. This is good. When I'm not missing something, it's a good thing. All right, we got the question back from Cece.
Okay.
She said, science has proven that ancestral memory exists with children of Holocaust survivors having stress disorders. Does your guest agree that the genetic memory does exist, and how can a person overcome that memory?
Overcome it. Interesting. Well, let's start with the idea that first, yes, I firmly do believe that the ancestral memory is passed to us through the DNA, and that I believe that the past ancestors are sentient, and they are communicating with us from the cellular level. So it's not just a random memory that's trapped in some fiber of the DNA, energetically or materially. It would be more that the conscious beings are interfacing through this DNA. I think the DNA is carries a lot more than we understand. Now, as far as the final question was something about how do you
rid yourself of it?
Rid yourself.
Rid yourself. Yeah.
Well, again, it's breaking up the logjam, you know, because what you really need to do is integrate it, interface with it, and redeem it. I have a section in the book that talks about how to do that, because sometimes things are off or the resonance isn't quite clear enough. You got to do some fine tuning. So if there's bad juju in the ancestral energy that you're feeling, there's a logjam. You need to redeem it. And the idea that the ancestors passed to me is because we are the living stewards of the blood lineage that we are right now. If you're German, French, whatever, you are the living representative of that bloodline. So we call you the steward of that bloodline. Now, in days of old, a steward served in place of a king. So it's really a noble office. So you can, by the authority of being a steward of your blood lineage, you can turn around and redeem the ancestors. Forgive them, pardon them, whatever the case may be, through your office, if you will, of steward. So that's one way you can dissipate this negative energy, is you can literally say to your ancestors, "I, as steward of our lineage, I release you from that which binds you, or that which creates disharmony, or you know whatever it might be that you're feeling. I release you as the living steward of our bloodline." And there can be a very energetic exchange that will heal that.
Well, yeah, and I was reading in the Redemption and Healing about in the book. And, you know, you speak of what you just said, that the ancestors, some of them need to be released from the energy of misdeeds or serious wrongdoings or whatever. And we can do for them, and what we can do for them, we can, in sometimes a major way, relieve the burdens, as you said, that they might be carrying. But they're also around to help us. We can help them, and in some cases, they can help us with, I think, if I'm not mistaken, we're talking about maybe chronic illness throughout the family, you know, something like that. So it's a win-win situation because... we help them, they help us, and it all kind of works out.
Right. There's one technique which they were passing to me about diseases, because our ancestors have had every disease probably there you can think of.
Right.
So then there's also the ancestors who survived all of those things, and both of those ancestors are in our DNA. And this is where the problem, as above, so below, is this predisposition to disease that people have. Because there's cancer in your family, there's, you know, whatever. So that's where the vigilance that needs to take place, and that's where you can turn to your ancestors and say, you know, I now have this disease. And I call upon my ancestors who survived it and those who never had it to now come to my aid. And genetically regenerate the healthy cells, stop the production of the negative cells, and lend your energy now to my body, which flows the blood that was once yours, and help me generate the healing from within. So that's one way you can also deal with that connection.
Mm-hmm. And by doing that, as what you just described, you're not only possibly helping yourself, but you're also helping future generations.
Absolutely. Yeah, it goes both ways.
Yeah, it's a good deed. Got a question from chat. Cater wants to know, when will a person stop reincarnating? What is the cause of a person from reincarnating? I'm just reading it as I see it, but you get the idea, right?
No, I understand the question. Right. From an occult point of view, our souls are what's reincarnating, by the way, not us. Mm-hmm. But when a souls need to come into this dimension to learn finite reality, because they exist in a realm that's rather dreamlike, they're mm-hmm. celestial beings, our souls are. So they sort of live in the dream world where things are constantly changing and there's really no order to anything. You know, in a dream, you may need to pick up a hose to put out a fire, and you end up picking up a piece of licorice, and you're eating the licorice and walking down the street all of a sudden. You know, there's no way to get anywhere. So souls have that natural consciousness. But what they learn here is reality on the finite level, where there's step 1, 2, 3, and 4 to something. Time is linear. Things are sequential. It's a whole different reality than the dream world mind that the soul is natural to. So once the soul has returned a numerous amount of times and learned all of the lessons that can be learned by finite reality, and also had experiences with other beings to learn compassion in particular, empathy, once a soul reaches that resonance, that vibration, according to occult teachings, it does not need to come back to material reality anymore. It begins rebirth within spiritual realms, as above, so below. But some of these souls who don't need to come back again because they've liberated themselves from the wheel of rebirth, sometimes they will come back as a sacrifice, and they become the avatars like Buddha and Krishna and, you know, these were souls that didn't need to come back anymore, but came back because they had great compassion for the plight of people stuck in material reality. So anyway, that's a short answer. A soul will no longer be reborn when it has learned all the lessons that material existence can provide it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sherry just asked a question, but I need a little more clarification. Sherry, can you clarify what you mean by that, please? All right, sorry. Just have to figure some of this stuff up. In the meantime, who are the spirit riders?
The spirit riders. Mm-hmm. This was something new that came through the book. There are very, very old stories about the ancestral spirit, and they're retained in the myths of the Mayans and in the myths of the ancient Hawaiian kahunas, about that an ancestor can leave the hive memory and journey to abide with a living, you know, let's say you or myself, a living agent of that lineage. And it takes on the form of a serpent. And it looks very much like our spine, and it sort of interfaces with us by overlaying itself in our spine. But it bears in its mouth, which is when you look at the imagery, the mouth is right about in the third eye, and so this eye is popping out of the serpent's mouth, and it is the ancestral eye. We as the living allow the spirit rider to come and look out this ancestral eye into the world that its descendants have created. And so the ancestors sort of take all that in for their collective knowledge. Then as a thank you, they turn that eye around and look at us in that eye, and we actually go down that eye, down through the serpent, out through its tail, and back into the ancestral realm. So we really get a moment to be imbued by the ancestral hive. Very, very powerful thing. So I developed a technique to work within the book called the Spirit Writer. It's just one way to intimately interface and connect with the ancestors.
I like that.
People will use it. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of things in the book. I mean, this book is very interactive. You know, you're not just sitting down and reading a book. There are exercises. There are, you know, guided visuals and stuff. I mean, it's the whole package. So if anybody's, well, I might not understand what they're talking about, it's written very, very plainly. It's not like, you know, a college textbook where you got to beat your head against the wall. It's not. It's easy. It's an easy read. It's easily understandable. And you can participate. You can not only learn and read about it, you can participate in this. And that's what I think is so important. There's something for everybody and then some, I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. It's a different book than any I've written before. The voice is even different. People who have read my books over time have said, wow, there's a different voice here. And one friend of mine said, well, you know, it's like your other books talked about what you've learned and, you know, sort of your knowledge and wisdom or whatever you might say about someone. They said, but this book, along with your last couple of ones, shows us you, the practitioner, not the teacher, but the practitioner. And I thought that was a very high compliment. Because the book is written very simple. It's not a complicated subject. Some people might think it is, but it's just so simple, and the ancestors are with you on each page. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, I know what it's like. It's kind of like divine intervention when you're writing something as a writer. I did a book where I didn't know what was coming up on the next page. It was more like reading a book than writing it.
Exactly.
And that's what made it so exciting. I mean, you know you're getting help then. You know, and then especially when you go back and start doing the editing and you go, wait a minute, I couldn't have possibly been that brilliant. You know, I didn't write that. You know, it came from something
else. I've had that experience when I had to read the proof before it went off to the printer. I sat and had to read the book over again, and there were sections in there, like you said, I swear, I never wrote that. I never saw that. I don't even remember that being in anywhere in what was going on, but there it was nonetheless, and it was good stuff.
Yeah, and it's exciting to sit there because it's not like work. It's like it's like you're a student and your fingers are moving and your brain is supposedly working, but it's not really because you're just hearing things and getting messages and it's flowing through you. And it's an amazingly good feeling. And to be the student and to be the one that's receiving this, just knowing that you can is kind of a great feeling as well.
Right. Yeah, I felt my role was to take everything that was flowing to me and put it into cohesive modules that relayed the core essence of what was trying to be said. So each chapter is hopefully taking people through kind of the spiritual feeling and along with the teachings, just hearing about the process of the ancestors, the idea of how powerful your breath is, because on your breath is the vapors of the blood that's flowing through your lungs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it keeps repeating these themes of the life breath that once was in the ancestors' lungs, the blood that flowed through their bodies. It's all within you now, which means all of them are within you now.
Mm-hmm.
And to realize how much power that bestows upon us, people probably have never stopped to realize what that means to be the steward of your living lineage. It's powerful.
Mm-hmm. It's a job. It's a title. It's
an office.
Part of the process is what it is, basically.
Yeah.
All right. The question that I was looking for, she said, can people see the other side from here? So I wrote back. I said, well, mediums do it all the time. You know, I didn't know what she was getting at. I said, did you mean something different? She says, well, I thought only mediums spoke with those on the other side. But she says, but like spirit and their world, can regular people, I guess, open up and see that?
Sure. I think mediums have just honed their skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't believe you have to be one. I think that they can be very effective.
Right.
But we have to remember, again, our personal power. This is what people forget. We are immensely powerful beings. So, you know, it's very simple to communicate with the spirits around us. Our ancestors have for countless centuries. So all we need to do is remember who we are, that we are the living steward of a lineage that goes back to the very beginning of time. All of our ancestors had to live long enough to reproduce in an unbroken chain for us to be here. So we've come a long way, and now we stand at the end of this river of blood. You can easily talk to spirits. You can easily hear what spirits have to say. You just have to accept that you have the ability to do that and make it so. Mm-hmm. You can start very simply. It's easier to communicate with the dead because they're still around us more than it is the ancestors. But either way, what I do is I always include the symbol of a human skull on my altar.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a red candle on top of that skull. And as the red wax flows down the candle, I imagine that as the living river of blood, which is connecting me with the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll sit and watch that dripping wax go down on the skull of this image of my ancestors, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just start talking to them and watching them dripping with the blood of our lineage. And it's a powerful way to begin finding a way to communicate with them.
Yeah, it is. And I think everybody can communicate in different ways. Some people mm-hmm. are clairaudient. Some people are clairsentient. Mm-hmm. Some people see, some people hear, some people smell, some people get smacked upside the head, and they usually deserve it because ancestors know best. everybody has, I believe, everybody has the capacity and the capability to do it.
Yes,
some people don't want to. They don't care to. That's fine. You know, they're not going to burn in hell for it if they think that's where they may be going.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody has their own way of listening.
Yes, absolutely. It doesn't have to be profound. It doesn't have to be physically seeing them, sensing mm-hmm. them. I can feel the dead touch me sometimes, physically touch
uh-huh.
me. I don't see them when they do that, but I can certainly feel their hand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just another way of communicating.
Yeah. I've been touched, and I'm more clairaudient than anything else, but, I don't like labels. I can do this, I can do that. If we just open up and let spirit come through to us in any way that they, because frankly, they're smarter than we are. They know the best way to get through to us. They know that if they appear to some people, that person may join them in spirit real quickly, but if you hear something or if you get a gentle touch or something like that, they know what to do. So I don't think people need to be afraid of opening up to that point. You don't walk around, keep the third eye open all the time and, let every Tom, Dick, and Harry spirit that you know or don't know come through.
Right.
You have to kind of pick and choose and close that eye up when you're not using it. But I think mm-hmm. it's something that mm-hmm. everybody should can do. And, when you're talking about the guided imagery and stuff that you're doing in the book, that's kind of a way to open up. If you read it, if you follow it, if you end up where you're there, somebody will probably send in a question and say, well, is that astral travel?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know better than I do about this. I kind of think maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know.
Well, to me, it's more in inner world projection. It's more entering into the inner mechanisms, mm-hmm. these inner planes, than it really is astral, because the astral is a realm unto itself. But these other ways we have, these inner planes, they kind of overlap all of that. They're not in or out of either one of them. So inner planes is like, for example, I would call the ancestral cavern more inner planes than I would astral, although it has astral, characteristics. Mm-hmm. It's more of an inner planes mechanism than it is an astral, plane.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. I'm also looking at something right now. You talk in the book about finding and working with sacred sites and power places and special portals to the ancients. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think, again, you know, these ancient sites were very profound statements by our ancestors. You know, I talk a little bit about Stonehenge in my new DVD. And I talk about the idea that these stones, which were weighed tons and were very difficult to transport, mm-hmm. you know, were quarried 300-400 miles away and dragged to a particular spot. Why would you do that? Mm-hmm. If it's just about building Stonehenge, why didn't you do it 20 feet from the quarry? You know, yeah. Would have been a lot simpler. But
right.
But for some reason, no, it had to be there. Mm-hmm. So that to me suggests that the ancestors really were very profound in creating these particular spots in that place. So that when you went there, that was the major ancestral connection for the race of the people. See, I think it's different than little temples in which groups and tribes gathered, each having their own. I think something like Stonehenge or the Rollwright stones were major areas that the ancestors had claimed to mark out that time forever. To say, mm-hmm. this is a portal, this is a doorway, this is the earth memory, the ancestral memory of our mm-hmm. race. So I think that that's why seeking out these places, and all places have them. I mean, even in the U.S., there are ancient sites. You know, we're a young country, but the land was here long before we were a country, and there are ancient sites even here in North America mm-hmm. That are very much like the European ones. So we can see that the ancestors have left these portals, and I think that they are saying, you know, if you need the major doorway, if you need the major reboot, you know what I mean? Go there, and you can upload all of that. Whereas, you know, if you're just home, you know, and you've got a little rock altar that you made in your backyard, that may not be as powerful a portal to the ancestors as some Neolithic site that's been there forever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And in the short term, I mean, going to an ancestor's back to the grave thing, that would be, for mm-hmm. us, one of those places of power. Mm-hmm. Cater in chat room is asking, she says, what makes a location or area unique as a place of power? Do we feel something there?
Yeah, absolutely. Several anthropologists in the past have written about the idea that humans don't create sacred space, they find it. And so none of these ancient sites were just arbitrarily, well, let's call this sacred and build a site here. They felt sacredness before they built the site. There was something more special, something more resonant, something more something in that one area there than even 100 feet away from it. And so the ancestors found these areas and then they erected stones and monuments on them to mark them, to show people this is where it's at. This is one of those centers. Mm-hmm. But you don't just say, well, you know what, I bought this ranch and I'm going to decide that out in the middle where that tree is, this is a sacred site. That may or may not be true.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at the way that our ancestors viewed this, they found sacred sites. They did not create them.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of like, you know, I mean, this is an odd analogy but or allegory, but, you know, when people go picnicking, you know, you'll see people enter a picnic site and they're walking around looking for a place to park, you know, and they'll stop and look at one place and they'll inch a few away and then they'll kind of back up, you know, it looks funny because they're looking for a particular place to sit.
Yeah.
And what's guiding that? What is it they're seeking? And what's telling them that that's the spot? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost like that ancestral thing is you're looking for your spot. It pre-existed you. You just got to find it.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect analogy because you do. You feel, you know, you might be 3 feet away from the place that you don't want to be because you just feel better 3 feet away. And it's not that there's anything else around you. It may not be, you know.
Right, right. Or,
yeah.
But you see people do it all the time, you know, and it's almost funny, you know.
Well, we do it when we're going to sit in the movie theater as well. I mean, we find a seat that, you know, is comfortable for us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because time is flying away annoyingly quickly, I'd like to tell everybody that we've just really barely scratched the surface on exploring the ancestral realm, and the book has so much more to offer. And once again, I'm going to hop up on my soapbox for a millisecond and say that it's really important for all of us to remember and acknowledge those who have gone before. Now, the best way for you to accomplish this, here it comes, is to get the book. It's called Communing with Ancestors. And Raven, where can people find it?
It should be available in any major bookstore. You can also, of course, get it online at my wife's shop, which is ravensloft.biz, B-I-Z. And, of course, Amazon carries it. It should be very easy to get hold of a copy. And I do hope people will work with the techniques in this book. One of the things the ancestors want to do is help us turn the tide of destruction on this planet. And we have the power to do it as the living stewards of that bloodline of our ancestors. But we need to talk to the ancestors and have them guide us to be able to turn the tide. And that's why working with some of these exercises is so important, because it makes us active.
Mm-hmm. And where can people find out more about you and your other books aside from the shop?
The best place to go is houseofgrimassi.com. It's sort of our umbrella website, and all the other things we have you can link to from there. So houseofgrimassi.com.
And she wants to know, how do you spell your last name, please?
Grimassi.
Okay, see, my listeners are right on the ball. They want to make sure they're getting it right so they can go out and get the book. This is perfect. Well, I think we need to kind of toddle off here, but I want to thank you so much for joining me this evening. Like I said, my eyes lit up when I got the book, and I smiled while I was reading through the whole book, and I'm just so happy that you were able to come on and talk about it, and hopefully at some point down the line we can talk about some of your other books. You'll come back, and I would look forward to that, and I think...
Yeah.
I
thank you for having me on the show. It was a great pleasure, and I hope we can do this again.
We shall. And I want to thank everybody in the chat room and those who are listening outside the chat room. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet
this
again. Good night.
Edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at this same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2014. Moonlight Hall by Kevin MacLeod, licensed through Incompetech.com.